In September 1932, just after dusk, J.T. stood in Hartwell's archive in Oxford with the brass key that had cut the same warm groove into his palm for years. The storm had been worrying the leaded windows all afternoon. By evening, it sounded less like rain than a hand testing weak places in a wall. The corridor lamps went gold in the damp, then thin, then gold again as the wind passed over them. J.T. stood with the closing ledger open beneath one thumb, and the box latchkey warm in his other hand. And for a moment, he let the house make its own small noises around him. He was the keeper of records now. That was the plain phrase for it, and Hartwell liked plain phrases when they described labor, and silkier ones when they described power. He signed the ledger, checked the archive door, checked it again, and folded the page over with the care of a man flattening a wound. The house had educated him, used him, housed him, and taught him to feel grateful in the manner of the indebted.
Even after all this time, he still felt the old reflex: keep the room tidy, keep the papers in order, keep yourself useful, and perhaps the institution will not turn and name you what you are. Tonight, his only honest task was to leave the archive clean and go back to his rooms before the weather got mean enough to fetch the men with candles. The box on the table had spoiled the evening. It was a hard, dark thing, old oak or something trying to imitate it, with brass corners dulled by touch. The catalog card beside it was already too neat. That was the first bad sign. J.T.
had taken it from the archive drawer with his keys and recognized the handwriting at once, though the wording had been softened in the copy, as if somebody had tried to round the edges off the past and expected the past to be pleased about it. The card named a seminar packet from 1911, assorted papers, notes, and correspondence. The box, when he lifted the lid, held more patience than that description deserved, and less than it ought to have. He set the brass key down, found the latch key, and opened the box again with a touch so light it might have been a courtesy. The first thing he noticed was the empty slot. It sat in the lined paper, like a tooth missing from a mouth. Not a dramatic absence, no torn fibers, no trace of water, no obvious theft. Just a shape made by something once present and now gone. The rest of the contents had been arranged around it with enough care to make the gap feel deliberate, almost ceremonial. A folded sheet of figures, a clipped invitation, a railway ticket, a note on cream paper in a hand too poised to be casual, a violin part marked in pencil, and nothing where the letter ought to have been. J.T. kept his face still. He had become good at that, good enough to be mistaken for calm. Then he touched the objects one by one, and the room went backward. He saw the selection room first, not as it had been, but as it had felt. Overwarmed, polished, and faintly stale, with the smell of coal dust carried in on wet coats. Hartwell, in 1911, had been a bright place for people who were used to being admitted. The windows were open just enough to suggest freshness without inviting weather. J.T. sat at the side table with a ledger and a pen that kept catching on the paper fibers, his scholarship coat too dark and too plain for the room, his hands placed carefully where they could be seen but not noticed.
They had told him, very gently, that he was there to assist. Jake arrived first, with rain on his shoulders and money in his smile. He had that look of a man who entered a room as if it had been waiting for him to improve it. He shook water from his hat and glanced around with a kind of amused ownership. "Well," Jake said, dropping into the chair as though he had brought it with him,
This is a grand mausoleum for a seminar. Lillian followed, gloves immaculate, eyes taking the room apart and putting it back together in one glance. She did not hurry. She never hurried. The threshold seemed to arrange itself around her.
If you must call it a mausoleum, she said, at least do try to be quiet in it. Katie came with a smile already sharpened for use. She looked from Jake to Lillian to JT and made quick work of the room's social geometry. You are both dreadful, she said, and I've only just sat down. Klaus arrived last among the first wave, exact and dry, as if he had decided in advance that nothing in England was worth a surprise. He removed his gloves finger by finger and set them together on the table. I had hoped, he said, for something more serious than theatrics. Jake laughed. You'll get serious soon enough, I expect.
Money usually does that to a man. Klaus's mouth moved by the smallest degree. Money does that to everyone.
JT wrote names while they spoke. He remembered how he had been trained to listen for the things said around the things said. Jake was wealth that did not apologize for itself. Klaus was control pretending not to be fear. Lillian was access. Katie was appetite, wearing wit like scent. And JT, in the corner with his pen, was the fellow who knew how to make their names into records and keep his own breath out of the way. The selection had looked, at first, like courtesy. It had been sorting. That was the truth of it.
Hartwell had a talent for turning sorting into ceremony. The questions were all polite. Who had the references? Who could travel? Who could present? Who came recommended? Who had the right connections in the right places and the right sort of father in the right sort of position? The room did not say class aloud. It did not have to. Class sat in the chairs, folded into the cuffs, and leaned on the mantel. Katie, watching JT write, had said in a voice pitched just for him, "You look as if you're preparing our epitaphs." He had not looked up.
"Only the minutes."
"That sounds worse," she said, and there had been a bright little edge of laughter in it. Jake had leaned forward, elbows on his knees. "What do you think, then? Are we worthy?"
JT had been young enough to believe that carefulness could pass for neutrality. "The committee will decide." Lillian's smile had made the word committee sound both admirable and faintly ridiculous. "A good answer," she had said. "And a safe one." Safe. That word had followed him for years like a small dog that did not know when it was being insulting. The box on Hartwell's table held the afterlife of that room. Not all of it.
The empty space proved that. But enough to sting.
He touched the folded sheet of figures next. Nick's handwriting, blunt and unadorned, with totals lined up like ballast. JT remembered Nick then, on the liner later, leaning over a table with a pencil jammed behind one ear and a ledger spread open under his hands while the ship rolled beneath them. Nick had looked offended by waste in all forms. "These numbers do not improve by being looked at prettily," Nick had said, tapping the page once. "They're wrong or they aren't. We can stop pretending elegance is a substitute." Jake had thrown him an easy grin.
"You make arithmetic sound like a sermon."
"I'd rather it were," Nick had said.
"Sermons are easier to ignore if they're wrong."
JT had remembered the salt and varnish of the ship's common room, the brass rail warm under his palm, the sound of cutlery in the dining saloon above them. They had gone from rail to port to liner in a sequence of damp stations, porters huffing under trunks, labels tied to handles, timetables folded and refolded until the edges had gone soft. Southampton had smelled of coal smoke, wet rope, and hot tea poured too quickly. The liner had smelled of everything else. Steam, starch, machine oil, money washed in cold water and then polished. JT had stood on deck once at dusk and watched the wake silver itself in the dark. The sea had not cared who had a name and who had a scholarship. That, more than anything, had felt like insult and mercy together. On board, the group had arranged itself in little predictable hierarchies. Jake took space as if it were a right. Klaus took it as if he had measured it. Lillian made room without appearing to. Katie made people volunteer what they had meant to conceal. Nick kept to figures. Marina kept to her music.
Amitra kept to the truth, which made the others restless. The first time JT saw Amitra properly was at the rail after supper, her shawl pinned hard against the wind. She had one hand on the polished wood and the other around a folded letter, her knuckles pale with pressure. She was not looking at the sea. She was looking at the horizon in the manner of someone who had already judged it and found it wanting. Jake came up behind her with the easy confidence of a man who mistook charm for permission. "You ought to come inside," he said. "The deck's no place for a beautiful woman to freeze herself into a sermon." Amitra did not turn.
"You ought to stop speaking as if weather were impressed by you."
Jake laughed as if she had flirted.
"That's sharp. That's accurate."
Klaus had joined them by then, hands behind his back, expression professionally mild.
"We are discussing practicalities," he said.
"We are not," Amitra replied. "You are. I am objecting."
Katie, appearing from nowhere with a cigarette she had no intention of lighting, had said, "Oh, let her object. It gives the rest of us something to do with our faces." The men had frowned. Marina, coming up a step behind them with her violin case under one arm, had said nothing at all.
She had only looked from Amitra to Jake and back again, as if measuring the distance between a sound and the damage it could do. JT had written the exchange down later in his notebook in reduced form. Objected. Misunderstanding. Practical discussion continued. The notebook had kept the facts and dropped the heat. That had been the habit. It had seemed sensible then. It seemed, now, like a hand over the mouth. He turned the next object over and felt the whole memory of Oxford thicken around him.
The arrival had been rain-slick and colder than anyone had expected after the crossing. The college walls dark with damp, the stones made almost black by weather. They came in by rail from the port. Trunks delivered first, then coats, then the people themselves. The station clock had been wrong by 2 minutes, which annoyed Nick and amused Jake and gave Katie something to say about the unreliability of empires and train companies. Lillian arranged the carriages with the confidence of someone who believed the road might be hostile but could be socially corrected. Klaus checked the schedule.
Marina held her case as if it contained a living thing. Amitra watched the porter, who was made to do the lifting, and said flatly, "You may keep your station if I may keep my dignity." The porter, who had heard this sort of arrangement before, said nothing and took the heavier trunk anyway. JT saw the look on her face and looked away, ashamed of the relief that he had not been singled out to refuse a laborer's indignity in public. At Hartwell, the rooms had been assigned in a way that claimed to be practical and had the usual shape of privilege underneath. Jake and Klaus had the better windows.
Lillian's room adjoined the corridor where visitors had to pass if they wanted to be seen arriving. Katie's room was near enough to the drawing room to make exits possible, and not so near as to make them easy.
Marina had been given a space with an upright piano in the next room. Amitra had been placed where the house could pretend not to have opinions while having all of them. Nick took the room with the smallest grate and looked at it as if room size were an insult to be corrected by arithmetic. JT was given a narrow chamber near the archive stairs, convenient for labor and far from any assumption of comfort.
There had been a dinner, naturally. Hartwell was fond of dinners, the way old regimes are fond of uniforms. Linen, silver, quiet instruction, and the slow passing of dishes, as if the right sauce could soften hierarchy. JT had stood at the sideboard and listened. He remembered Jake praising risk with his fork in hand, as if appetite lent the word authority. He remembered Klaus explaining the canal proposal in a voice so controlled it almost passed for humanitarian. He remembered Lillian saying, with a calmness that cut deeper than anger, that one had to preserve the line between prudence and panic.
He remembered Katie smiling at the wrong moment and making the wrong man laugh, which gave her leverage in the room. He remembered Nick asking for figures when everyone else wanted adjectives. He remembered Amitra saying that if a scheme depended on making other people invisible, it deserved to fail in daylight. Jake had leaned back then, one leg crossed over the other. That sounds awfully noble. It sounds accurate, Amitra had said. Accurate is not enough, Klaus had replied. Amitra's gaze had gone to him and stayed there. It's enough to begin with. JT had written the exchange down in near silence. His hand had not shaken.
That had mattered to him then. The fact that he could keep his face neutral under pressure had felt like a talent. In truth, it had only been a way of staying employable in rooms that liked obedience better than thought. The Atlantic crossing had made them a little more honest and a little more exhausted. The ship had narrowed them to corridors, decks, dining hours, and weather. There was nowhere to vanish except one's own cabin. That was perhaps why truth appeared in scraps. Nick's figures were checked and rechecked at a table by the portholes, while sea light shifted across the page.
Katie made jokes sharp enough to draw blood, and then laughed first, which made it harder to say she had done damage. Jake flirted with everybody, and meant it as a form of conquest. Klaus watched the accounts as if morality were a line item. Lillian kept invitations folded in her glove and distributed them like favors. Marina played on the promenade once, the sound of her violin carrying through the corridor before the music itself did. Amitra wrote letters and sealed them with a firm, almost angry press of her thumb. JT
had been on deck one afternoon when Jake, unbothered by the cold, had said to no one in particular, "The canal will pay for itself 10 times over once it's moving." Nick had not looked up from his notes. "Show me where." Jake had laughed. "You and your show me where." "Yes," Nick said. "That is how figures work." Klaus, who had been standing by the rail with his hands tucked under his coat, had turned his head the smallest amount. "The labor costs are already known." Amitra's voice came from behind them. "Known to whom?" Klaus's jaw had tightened. "To anyone reading the estimates." "And who wrote them?" she asked.
Jake gave a small shrug. "The men who know the business." Amitra had smiled then, but there had been no softness in it. "That's the trouble. Men who know the business always seem to know the cost of labor, and never the worth of the laborer." The phrase had landed with a clean, hard sound. Even Jake had not answered at once. JT had lowered his eyes to the deck, feeling the old instinct to become harmless.
it had been easier to be the man with the ledger. The ledger did not ask him to choose sides, or so he had told himself. He touched the sheet of figures again. Nick's hand, precise and unshowy.
The columns alone had made the scheme look less like an idea and more like a machine with teeth. JT remembered how Nick had once slid the page across the table and said to him quietly, "You ought to look at this, JT. You keep records. You know what a missing line means." JT had looked, then nodded, then said nothing useful. He had let the room continue around him. The archive paper under his fingers had gone dry and brittle with age. He lifted the next item, and a note slipped out from underneath it, folded once, the paper creased from being opened and closed more than it ought to have been.
Katie's hand, quick and slanted, with a line that began as a joke and ended as a warning. It made him think of how she had sat cross-legged on a trunk in Oxford, hatpin glinting under the lamp, and told him with a smile that she liked him best when he was difficult to read. "That's a shame," JT had said. "It is," she had replied. "Easy men are usually dull." Jake had heard that and grinned. "You see? She's kind enough to say it." Katie had tipped her head. "Kindness has never been my strongest suit." JT had almost smiled. Almost. He had not then, and the not smiling had felt like discipline.
He turned the folded note in his hand now and saw, with a cold little throb of recognition, that it belonged with the box, but not with the story the box pretended to tell. It was a map of access, a dinner seating plan, a place card, an invitation that could be withheld or slipped forward. Lillian's work, or the world she understood best. Hartwell had always believed in paper, when paper could manage what speech could not. A seat at table was never just a seat. It was permission to be heard, to be seen, to be protected from interruption. Those who arranged the seats decided whose silence counted as courtesy and whose counted as insignificance.
He had known that then. He had only not admitted what it cost. The wind hit the windows in one long shove. The archive lamps flickered and steadied. JT set the note down and drew the violin part toward him. Marina's handwriting was thin and exact in the margins, the pencil marks a little darker where she had leaned into the page. He remembered her in the small music room at Hartwell after the first seminar dinner, the dress at her wrists too plain for the room, and the bow in her hand held as if she were not entirely convinced the house deserved a sound from her.
The others had been arguing in the drawing room over figures and routes and whether an objection counted if it was not practical. The talk had become one of those polished fights in which nobody was entirely honest, but everybody hoped to win. Then Marina had entered, without announcing herself, and closed the door behind her with a quiet click. "You're all talking over the same point," she had said.
Jake had leaned back in his chair, amused. "And what point is that?" "That the people who will be most useful to your scheme are the least likely to be asked." The room had shifted. Not much. Enough. Klaus had folded one hand over the other.
"We are discussing logistics." "Then discuss them plainly," Marina had said. Lillian, sitting very straight with a teacup untouched beside her, had said, "Plain speech can be crude."
"Cruel speech can be elegant," Marina answered. And that had been that.
Katie had hidden a smile behind her cup. Nick had looked down at his figures with the expression of a man pleased, briefly, to be in the presence of intelligence. Amitra had not moved. JT had felt the room tighten,
every social thread pulled a little tauter. And then Marina had lifted her violin, tucked it under her chin, and played. It was only a phrase, not even a full movement.
A brief, tender line that climbed and turned back on itself, as if it had remembered a wound and was trying not to touch it. The sound went through the room like warm water through a cold glass. It changed the temperature. It did not change the structure. Jake had gone still in spite of himself. Even Klaus had looked up. Lillian's face had softened into something almost human. For 6 or 7 breaths, there had been nothing but the bow drawing across the strings, the small scrape at the beginning of each note, the room's own unwilling listening. J.T.
remembered the strange ache of it, the sense that kindness could exist in the same house as cowardice and not be protected from it. When Marina lowered the violin, the silence after was sharper than before. "There," she had said. "Now you may continue pretending." Katie let out a soft laugh. That was unkind. "It was accurate," Amitra said, and Marina's mouth had curved for the briefest moment at the echo. Then Nick had laid his figures on the table, as if he were setting down a knife. "The numbers don't support the route as proposed," he said.
"Not if you account for labor displacement, port fees, and the contingency losses in the canal contracts." Jake had tapped the table once. "Everything can be made to support itself, if you have the nerve." Nick looked at him. "No. That's what people say when they haven't done the math." Amitra had taken the paper, read the figures, and handed them back. "This is not a route. It's a cut." Klaus's eyes had gone cool as steel. "You're overstating it." "I'm understating it," she had said. "You've drawn profit and named it progress." That was the moment, JT remembered, when the room acquired its real shape. Not one argument, but many. Jake's appetite, Klaus's control, Lillian's threshold work, Katie's leverage, Nick's exactness, Marina's fragile, hard-earned note of truth, Amitra's refusal to call extraction by any cleaner name, and JT in the corner, with his neat hand and his careful silence, deciding not to be difficult. He had understood enough then to be uneasy. He had not understood enough to risk himself. The memory eased back only when the archive lamp hummed, and the storm hit again, harder this time, rattling the panes in their lead. JT lifted his eyes from the box and stared at the empty slot, until the shape of it became a thought he could not avoid.
The missing thing was not missing at all. That knowledge arrived not as thunder, but as the memory of a desk drawer in his own study, the second drawer down on the right, the one that stuck if he pulled too quickly. Hartwell After Midnight, 1911. When the dinner had broken up and the arguments had thinned to whispered pairings in the corridor, and he had taken Amitra's letter from the table with a hand that felt stranger than his own. He had told himself he was preserving it. He had told himself he would copy it into the record in the morning, that he only needed a little more time to decide how to phrase what it said. The bluntness of it had been unbearable. JT stood very still at the archive table, the box open under his hand, and felt the old shame move through him with such force it almost looked like nausea. He had hidden the letter, not lost it, not misplaced it, hidden it in the desk drawer in his study, and then made a habit of not opening the drawer unless he had to. The catalog card had been softened afterward, the box labeled, the omission made neat enough to pass for tidiness.
a roll of thunder dragged along the roof. Somewhere below, a door shut. JT shut his eyes for 1 second, and then opened them.
The box's empty slot was the exact size of the letter folded into thirds. He set the violin part down carefully, as if it might accuse him if handled badly, and reached for the brass key again. The archive door still waited to be locked. He knew what he was going for now, and his pulse had changed from measured to ugly. He gathered the catalog card, the box, and the rest of the papers into a stack, then stopped, because a stack suggested order, and order was the lie that had carried him this far. Instead, he kept the box open, took the card in his hand, and carried them out under the weight of the unfinished record.
Hartwell's corridor clock marked the quarter after midnight as he locked the archive behind him and crossed to his study. The house had gone deep quiet, the kind of quiet that a storm only makes more visible. His own room smelled faintly of ink, coal dust, and damp wool. He set the catalog card on the desk, laid the box beside it, and pulled open the lower drawer with a jerk that made the wood complain. The drawer stuck half an inch, then gave. Inside, under two old envelopes and a bent receipt for train fare, lay Amitra's letter, still folded as he had left it all those years ago. J.T.
stood with his hand on the drawer handle and looked at it for a long time. Then he took the letter out and placed it on the desk beside the card and the box. And in the storm light from the window, he understood, at last, that Hartwell's innocence depended on his lie. Amitra's letter was not long. It did not need length. Her hand was steadier than anyone else's in the room, every line pressed down with the kind of patience that came from refusing to be hurried into a lie. JT read it once, then again. And the second reading hurt more. She had not written to flatter him.
She had written to the record, and to the man who was supposed to keep it. The canal proposal was not a scheme in her letter. It was theft dressed in administrative silk. The labor was not an unfortunate side effect. It was the point. The men with money and titles had taken a line through the map and called it progress. Then asked the rest of the world to admire the ink. She had named the porters, the dockmen, the families who would be uprooted, the local contractors who would be paid late or not at all, the way every clean phrase in the proposal hid a dirty hand.
And at the bottom, where her anger finally made room for plainness, she had written that if JT intended to keep their papers, then he must keep the parts that embarrassed them too. Keep them whole. He set the page down with care that felt almost obscene. The storm moved over Hartwell in a long, hard wash, the rain wrapping the window like a knuckle that would not be turned away. In the study's weak lamplight, the desk looked suddenly like what it was. Not a refuge, not a shelter. Just a piece of furniture where a man had once had the time to choose himself over the truth.
He stood there with his hand braced on the edge of the desk and stared at the letter until his eyes blurred. The shame came first, sharp and heatless. Then came the familiar attempt to step aside from it, to name it as a failing of youth, a matter of confusion, a moment of bad timing. He knew that trick too well. It had served him for years. It had kept him fed, employed, and respectable in rooms that liked a man who apologized to the furniture and not to the injured. None of that held now. He had hidden the letter for the room he wanted. That was the ugly, simple thing.
He had wanted Hartwell's approval. Wanted the degree of safety that came from being thought useful. Wanted the right to stand near men who spoke in titles and budgets and called it civilization. Amitra had risked the room by naming what they were doing. He had risked less and called the difference prudence. A laugh almost came out of him, but it was not laughter. It was the dry crack of a throat refusing to go soft. "Christ," he said to the empty room, and the words sounded worn out before it left him. He looked down at the box, at the catalog card, at the letter spread on the blotter. And the items stopped being separate. They became one record, one wound. He opened the box fully and lifted the shallow artifact tray free. Jake's lighter lay there, brass dull at the edges, the lid sprung with the easy confidence of a man who never expected his appetite to be refused. Klaus's ring, heavy and dark, sat in a small cloth sleeve, as if money had learned to be discreet. Katie's card, written in a hand that made even her address look like an invitation, had a corner rubbed soft from handling. Lillian's note was folded with immaculate contempt for disorder. Nick's figures were plain as a fist. Marina's sheet music was marked all through with small pencil corrections that looked at first like technique, and on the second look, like endurance. And Amitra's letter sat among them with none of the room's vanity on it at all. He gathered the objects one by one and set them in a line. It was a foolish act, perhaps, too neat by half, but he could feel the old habit in him reaching for order, and this time he let it do what it had always done in service of cowardice. He turned it against the lie. The lighter. Jake had used it after supper on the liner, flicking flame against the dark as if fire belonged to him by birth. He had never been able to leave a thing alone if it might be made to shine. JT remembered him in 1911, leaning back in the dining room chair with one ankle crossed over the other, a smile already loaded with mischief. "We can't be expected to run the whole thing on sentiment," Jake had said, and the words had been followed by that easy grin that made greed look like appetite, and appetite look like personality. Nick had not looked up from the figures. "No," he had said, "you seem content to run it on somebody else's losses." Jake had laughed, but it had been the wrong sort of laugh, thin at the edges. "You make me sound criminal." "No," Nick had said, tapping the page with one blunt finger. "I make you sound expensive." That had drawn a startled snort from Katie, who had been sitting with one elbow on the table and her chin in her palm. Lillian had given the smallest glance in his direction, as if deciding whether he was useful enough to be corrected. Klaus, on the other hand, had gone very still. Control never liked being named in public. The lighter on the desk caught the lamp and gave back a narrow gold glint. JT laid his hand over it for a second and felt the line of the memory settle. They had been elegant, those evenings, in the way polished harm often is. Linen, silver, small talk rehearsed to conceal the pressure underneath. The college had served lamb with mint, and Hartwell's dining room had glowed in the firelight as if warmth itself could excuse the conversation. Lillian had arranged the seating so that each person's influence seemed accidental and each person's dependence invisible. That was her gift. She could make a room seem chosen by fate when she had actually assembled it herself. Amitra had noticed at once. "You have seated us as though the argument were already decided," she had said, glancing from the place cards to Lillian with a steadiness that made the rest of the table feel underdressed. Lillian smiled. It was a graceful smile. It was also a wall. One seats people according to what they can contribute.
Amitra's gaze had moved to the head of the table, where the men of means sat with the confidence of those who had never been asked to justify their chairs. Then the room is already dishonest. Katie had let out a small laugh into her glass. We've only just begun, and she's gone and ruined it for everyone. Not ruined, Amitra said.
Exposed. Jake had taken a sip of wine and leaned in, making his voice warm with charm. You do like your words severe. I like them accurate, she answered. Klaus set his fork down. Accuracy is not the same as usefulness. No, Nick had said before anyone else could. But it's the condition for it. The table had gone quiet, in a way JT remembered as physical. He could feel it again now, the pressure of all that polished silver and all those educated mouths, suddenly made awkward by a refusal that would not take the shape they wanted.
It had been easier, in that silence, for him to study the edge of his plate than to study the world the others were building in plain sight. Jake had broken the pause with a shrug. Look, the canal opens a route the Empire can't ignore. Trade moves. Men move. Money moves. That's civilization. Amitra did not blink. No, that is extraction with better upholstery. Katie covered a smile with her hand. Marina, who had been sitting farther down the table with her posture nearly too still, lowered her eyes to the linen and said nothing. Her silence was never emptiness. JT had learned that only later. At the time, he had mistaken it for reserve.
Klaus's fingers had tightened once around his knife. You are speaking as if labor were abstract. Amitra's answer came without heat, which made it cut harder. You are speaking as if labor were not human. That one had landed clean. Even Jake had looked away for a moment. And JT had done what he had always done in difficult rooms. He had watched. He had taken in the exchange, waited, kept it in the part of himself that believed later understanding might count as virtue. He had told himself he was preserving the detail. He had told himself the record would be enough. The memory shifted with the next object.
Klaus's ring lay in its cloth like a piece of machinery that had learned to resemble jewelry. JT remembered Klaus on the liner, standing at the rail with his collar turned up against the wind, staring out as if the sea were another ledger to be balanced. He had the air of a man who thought moral discomfort was a tax others paid on his behalf. When Nick had shown him the revised figures, Klaus had not denied them at once. That would have been crude. He had looked at the page, looked back at Nick, and said in that precise, careful voice, "You are accounting for the wrong class of risk." Nick had held the paper steady.
"I'm accounting for people."
Klaus had given a faint, unpleasant smile. "And I am accounting for consequence."
"You mean profit," Katie had said from the nearest chair, not lifting her head from the magazine she was pretending to read.
"I mean reality," Klaus said. Amitra had looked up then. "No. You mean a reality in which only some people get to count." The men at the table had not liked that. It showed in the way they handled their cutlery, in the brief tightening of their mouths, in the little politenesses they reached for after being struck.
Lillian had smoothed the edge of the conversation at once, not by correcting the substance, but by shifting the frame. That had been her talent, too. She could make a wound look like a protocol issue. "Must we turn every discussion into a trial?" she had asked, mild as cream. Marina had answered from the far end, voice quiet and exact. "If the terms are violent enough, yes."
After supper,
when the argument had begun to drag itself in circles, she had opened her violin case and asked no permission at all. That had been its own kind of correction. JT laid her sheet music on the desk and remembered the sound before the notes. The music room at Hartwell had been too small for the number of people who kept trying to own it. The piano stood under a portrait of a dead dean who looked as though he disapproved of every living thing. The fire had burned low. Wet coats hung on the back of chairs.
Jake had been half-turned toward the window. Klaus had been on his feet, pretending to inspect the mantle, and Lillian had looked on with the expression of a woman who knew that permission was a resource and intended to spend it sparingly. Marina had not asked for silence. She had simply begun. It was only a brief phrase, a turn of melody, not performance in the grand sense, but a private act of conscience made audible. The first note came a little raw at the bow, then settled. The line rose and bent and returned, as if it had touched grief and chosen not to name it too quickly. The room changed around it. Not the politics, not the scheme, but the air. Even Jake stopped moving. Even Klaus listened, though he would rather have died than admit tenderness had caught him unprepared. When Marina finished, the silence afterward had felt stripped clean. Katie was the first to break it. "That was unkind," she said, and there was admiration under the teasing. Marina lifted one shoulder, the gesture small. It was honest. Amitra looked at her as if measuring a fellow witness. "That's the same thing, more often than people want." JT had wanted then to say something useful. He had wanted to tell Marina the room had heard her. He had wanted to say to Amitra that she was right.
He had wanted, in the simplest form, to stop sitting inside the inherited silence that passed for good behavior. Instead, he did what he had always done when the world demanded a spine and offered him a chair. He wrote it down later. He made the notes. He preserved the event in the language of a man trying not to be noticed. That was the lie in its mildest form. Not the worst of it, but the habit that made the worst possible. The rain eased for a moment, then returned in smaller taps. Dawn was not here yet, but the dark had begun to lose its depth. JT sat down heavily in the chair by the desk and put Amitra's letter before him again. He read it a third time, slower. This time, he let himself hear the thing she had been saying to him all along. Not just that the canal scheme was theft. Not just that the men at the table knew it and dressed it in the language of improvement. The harsher truth was that his silence had made room for it. Not alone. He had not built the thing. But he had helped preserve its respectable face. He had taken the part of the record that embarrassed the powerful and tucked it away from view. He had done it with a scholar's hands, which made the action cleaner only in appearance.
He looked at his own hands now, at the black smudge of ink on one thumb, at the stiffness in the knuckles from holding the box too long. They were the hands of a man who had spent years arranging evidence into tolerable shapes. He could see that plainly now, and wanted, briefly, to be sick. Instead, he breathed through it. Shame without self-pity. That, if anything, was the only decent way through it. Not to excuse, not to dramatize, not to crawl inside the injury as if suffering by itself were moral repair. He had no right to that. He had only the work.
He took out a fresh catalog card and a blank tie-on label from the stack in the drawer and set them beside the old one. The old one had been softened by another hand years ago, the edges of the description rounded into harmlessness. Seminar packet. Assorted papers. Correspondence. As though the box were a polite inconvenience rather than a sealed argument. He turned the old card face down. Then he wrote. His hand did not want to be plain at first. It reached for the college's accustomed phrases, for the kind of phrasing that made a thing sound filed and therefore harmless. He stopped himself. Wrote again. Stopped. Wrote once more.
The room gave him nothing. The storm gave him nothing. He had to do it without witness. Hartwell, Seminar Packet 1911. Correspondence, figures, note, and music restored. Withheld letter from Amitra filed as evidence of omitted content. Catalog corrected by J.T., 1932. He read it over and felt the air change just a little around the words. They were not beautiful. They were bare, and the bareness was the point. There was no deference left in them, no polish, no attempt to protect the institution from its own paper trail. He added one more line after a hesitation that lasted only a breath.
Former description, false by omission. There. That was the sentence he had been walking around for years. He copied the same bare description onto the tie-on label. The first light of morning had begun to seep into the window by then, thin and colorless over the wet glass. The storm had burned itself down to a low mutter. Somewhere below, a shutter banged once and was then caught. Hartwell, which had seemed all night like a house holding its breath, had begun to remember that it was built to endure weather and scandal both. JT gathered the artifacts into the box again, but more slowly now, with a different hand on each item.
Jake's lighter went in first. Appetite. Motion. The bright little lie that risk had no cost. Klaus's ring followed. Precision. Power disguised as order. Katie's card. Access. Sharpened into wit. Lillian's note. Thresholds. The gentle cruelty of deciding who gets admitted. Nick's figures. Wait. The stubborn fact that could not be made pretty. Marina's music. The sound of truth entering a room where truth had not been expected. The old catalog card. The lie, kept where it could be seen as a lie. Amitra's letter came last. He did not fold it smaller to make it easier. He placed it flat, as if it had a right to its own shape.
The empty slot in the lining was no longer empty. It had become a wound, healed badly but visibly, and that was enough. He closed the lid and heard the old box give its soft, dry click. Then he wrapped the corrected label around the bundle and tied it with archival string. The knot was clumsy at first. His fingers had gone a little stiff with cold and fatigue. He started over. The second knot held. He rose, took up the brass key and the box latch key, and crossed the corridor to the archive with the box under one arm. The house was quiet enough now to make each step sound formal. Not secret. Formal. The difference mattered.
The sky beyond the windows had gone from black to a bruised pearl gray, and the leaded glass held the reflection of a man who looked more tired than old. That, too, was accurate. At the archive door, he unlocked it with the brass key. At the archive table, he set the box down and opened the ledger to the proper page.
His entry hand had changed without his permission. It was less careful now. Not sloppier, just less eager to please. He copied the corrected label into the record and added a reference line to the restored letter. He noted the figures. He noted the music leaf. He noted the note. He noted the old catalog card.
He did not soften the description to spare any descendant the embarrassment of reading it. When he came to the line for provenance, he paused only long enough to make sure the words were the honest ones. Recovered from desk drawer in JT's study, where it was retained without authorization. The sentence sat there in the ledger as if it had always wanted to be born. His throat tightened, not with triumph, with the smaller, harder ache of consequence finally arriving in a shape he could not dodge. He imagined, not wildly, the future reader of this record. A graduate student, perhaps? A colleague?
Some archivist who would open the box and see the corrected label and understand that the house had once been forced to tell on itself. He imagined the damage that would do to Hartwell's polished story. He imagined his own place in the institution narrowing, perhaps ending, perhaps simply becoming less comfortable than it had been. Good, he thought, and was startled by the flatness of it. Good. Let it be damaged. Let it be known. The thought did not make him noble. It made him honest enough to continue. He took the catalog card he had written and slipped it into the catalog drawer where the old description had lived. He closed that drawer more carefully than he had opened it. Not gently. Carefully. He relocked the box with the latchkey, carried it back to its shelf, and set it in place. Then he stood for a long minute with the brass key warm in his palm and looked around the archive. The shelves rose in their dark ranks. The ledgers lay stacked. The room smelled of paper, dust, and the faint iron of wet wool drying too slowly. It was still Hartwell. It would remain Hartwell. One confession would not cleanse the place. It would not give back the years, or the labor, or the letter he had hidden, or the harm done under elegant words.
Understanding the past did not make it harmless. That, too, had to be kept. He shut the archive door and turned the key once. The storm had moved east by the time he returned to his study. A pale wash of morning lay over the stone outside, and the wet branches in the yard hung still, as if exhausted by what they had been asked to bear. He set the brass key on the desk beside the blotter, not with ceremony, but with decision, and the small metal sound it made was plain and final. Then he stood looking out through the window at the closed house and the washed stones and the garden where the rain had left its print on every leaf.
Hartwell no longer looked like a place keeping a clean lie. It looked like a house that had survived the storm and failed, at last, to survive the truth. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.